And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
With so many issues before us, from energy independence to global warming, global water crisis, well, we're hearing from a lot of people who are sharing their best visions for a better world. The idea of a global system to deal with the world's problems is certainly not new, and today we bring you another global vision, and we talk about saving the world with mushrooms. That's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
I listened to the evening news Monday night, and it was dominated by stories of natural disasters. The cyclone in Miramar, which has taken down at least 30,000, and perhaps double that, is yet another in the emerging stories of nature doing what it does. But with so many people clinging to scraps of land around the world, the outcome is shocking. The same is true in China, where a magnitude 7.8 quake, the strongest in 35 years, is still being probed to assess the damage. In one moment, the roof of a middle school collapsed, and with it, the lives of over 900 middle school students was no more. In Oklahoma, 170-mile-an-hour winds cut a swath of destruction, while in Maryland, flooding is forcing many coastal communities to head for higher ground. In all of these cases, the tragedy is based on having lots and lots of people trying to cohabit with nature. And as will always be the case, nature will win. In many of these cases, these same storms and quakes would have resulted in many fewer deaths had it happened maybe 40 or even 50 years ago, with many fewer people in the way. This is part of the story of today, trying to make sense of our future as humans and nature vie for power. In segment two of today's show, I'm going to frame this issue from a different perspective as we look at the emerging sense that a global response is needed. Can we do it? Will we do it? The answer may surprise you. Posing that question makes me think about the fact that I've been doing the Wild Side News now for over 4 years and have talked to literally hundreds of amazing people on almost every topic that is making the news today. But what's amazing are the solutions people are coming up with to deal with almost any of the challenges that face us. To this point, we now shift our attention to the Weekly Earth Summit as we look at one man's unique vision for the future of world peace through mushrooms. So now it's time for the Weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sydney Wildsmith, and today we hear from a visionary mushroom expert who demonstrates brilliantly why, if we only knew how to harness our collective genius to real-world outcomes, we would have no problem in finding solutions to the challenges that loom so large. So now, Renaissance mycologist Paul Stamets addresses the six ways mushrooms can help save the world.
I love a challenge, and saving the Earth is probably a good one. We all know the Earth is in trouble. We have now entered into 6X, the sixth major extinction on this planet. I often wondered if there was a United Organization of Organisms, otherwise known as uh-oh, and every organism had a right to vote, will we be voted on the planet or off the planet? I think that vote is occurring right now. I want to present to you a suite of six mycological solutions using fungi, and these solutions are based on mycelium. The mycelium infuses all landscapes. It holds soils together. It's extremely tenacious. It holds up to 30,000 times its mass. They're the grand molecular disassemblers of nature, the soil magicians. They generate the humus soils across the land masses of Earth. We have now discovered that there is a multidirectional transfer of nutrients between plants mitigated by the mycelium. So the mycelium is the mother that is giving nutrients from alder and birch trees to hemlock cedars and Douglas firs. Dusty and I, we like to say on Sunday, this is where we go to church. I'm in love with the old growth forest, and I'm a patriotic American because we have those. Most of you are familiar with portobello mushrooms. And frankly, I face a big obstacle when I mention mushrooms to somebody. They immediately think portobellos or magic mushrooms. Their eyes glaze over and they think I'm a little crazy. So I hope to pierce that prejudice forever with this group. We call it mycophobia, the irrational fear of the unknown when it comes to fungi. Mushrooms are very fast in their growth, day 21, day 23, day 25. Mushrooms produce strong antibiotics. In fact, we're more closely related to fungi than we are to any other kingdom. A group of 20 eukaryotic microbiologists published a paper 2 years ago erecting Opisthokonta, a super kingdom that joins Animalia and fungi together. We share in common the same pathogens. Fungi don't like to rot from bacteria, and so our best antibiotics come from fungi. But here is a mushroom that's past its prime. After they sporulate, they do rot. But I propose to you that the sequence of microbes that occur on rotting mushrooms are essential for the health of the forest that give rise to the trees that create the debris fields that feed the mycelium. And so we can see a mushroom here sporulating, and spores are germinating, and the mycelium forms and goes underground. In a single cubic inch of soil, there can be more than 8 miles of these cells. My foot is covering approximately 300 miles of mycelium. This is photomicrographs from Nick Reed and Patrick Hickey. And notice that as the mycelium grows, it conquers territory, and then it begins the net. I've been a scanning electron microscopist for many years. I have thousands of electron micrographs. And when I was staring at the mycelium, I realized that there are microfiltration membranes. We exhale carbon dioxide, so does mycelium. It inhales oxygen, just like we do. But these are essentially externalized stomachs and lungs. And I present to you the concept that these are extended neurological membranes. And in these cavities, these microcavities form, and as they fuse soils, they absorb water. These are little wells. And inside these wells, the microbial communities begin to form. And so the spongy soil not only resists erosion, but sets up a microbial universe that gives rise to a plurality of other organisms. I first proposed in the early 1990s that mycelium is Earth's natural internet. When you look at the mycelium, they're highly branched. And if there's one branch that is broken, then very quickly, because of the nodes of crossing, internet engineers maybe call them hop points, there's alternative pathways for channeling nutrients and information. The mycelium is sentient. It knows that you are there. When you walk across landscapes, it leaps up in the aftermath of your footsteps trying to grab debris. So I believe the invention of the computer internet is an inevitable consequence of a previously proven biologically successful model. The Earth invented the computer internet for its own benefit, and we now, being the top organism on this planet, is trying to allocate resources in order to protect the biosphere. Going way out, dark matter conforms to the same mycelial archetype. I believe matter begets life. Life becomes single cells. Single cells become strings. Strings become chains. Chains network. And this is the paradigm that we see throughout the universe. Most of you may not know that fungi were the first organisms to come to land. They came to land 1.3 billion years ago, and plants followed several hundred million years later. How is that possible? It's possible because the mycelium produces oxalic acids and many other acids and enzymes, pockmarking rock and grabbing calcium and other minerals and forming calcium oxalates, makes the rocks crumble in the first step in the generation of soil. Oxalic acid is two carbon dioxide molecules joined together. So fungi and mycelium sequester carbon dioxide in the form of calcium oxalates, and all sorts of other oxalates are also sequestering carbon dioxide through the minerals that are being formed and taken out of the rock matrix. This was first discovered in 1859. This is a photograph by Franz Huber. This photograph was taken in the 1950s from Saudi Arabia. 420 million years ago, this organism existed. It was called Prototaxides. Prototaxides, laying down, was about 3 feet tall. The tallest plants on Earth at that time were less than 2 feet. Dr. Boyce at the University of Chicago published an article in the Journal of Geology this past year determining that Prototaxides was a giant fungus, a giant mushroom. Across the landscapes of Earth were dotted these giant mushrooms all across most land masses, and these existed for tens of millions of years. Now, we've had several extinction events, and as we march forward 65 million years ago, most of you know about it, we had an asteroid impact. The Earth was struck by an asteroid. A huge amount of debris was jettisoned into the atmosphere. Sunlight was cut off, and fungi inherited the Earth. Those organisms that paired with fungi were rewarded, because fungi do not need light. More recently, at Einstein University, they just determined that fungi use radiation as a food, as a source of energy, much like plants use light. So the prospect of fungi existing on other planets elsewhere, I think, is a foregone conclusion, at least in my own mind. The largest organism in the world is in eastern Oregon. I couldn't miss it. It was 2,200 acres in size. 2,200 acres in size, 2,000 years old. The largest organism on the planet is a mycelial mat, one cell wall thick. How is it that this organism can be so large and yet be one cell wall thick, whereas we have five or six skin layers that protect us? The mycelium in the right conditions produces a mushroom. It bursts through with such ferocity it can break asphalt. We were involved in several experiments. I'm going to show you six, if I can, solutions for helping to save the world. Battelle Laboratories and I joined up in Bellingham, Washington. There were four piles saturated with diesel and other petroleum waste. One was a control pile. One pile was treated with enzymes. One pile was treated with bacteria. In our pile, we inoculated with mushroom mycelium. The mycelium absorbs the oil. The mycelium is producing enzymes, peroxidases, that break carbon-hydrogen bonds. These are the same bonds that hold hydrocarbons together. So the mycelium becomes saturated with the oil, and then when we return 6 weeks later, all the tarps were removed, all the other piles were dead, dark, and stinky. We came back to our pile, it was covered with hundreds of pounds of oyster mushrooms, and the color changed to a light form. The enzymes remanufactured the hydrocarbons into carbohydrates, fungal sugars. Some of these mushrooms are very happy mushrooms. They're very large, showing how much nutrition that they could have obtained. But something else happened, which is an epiphany in my life. They sporulated. The spores attract insects. Insects laid eggs. Eggs became larvae. Birds then came bringing in seeds. And our pile became an oasis of life, whereas the other three piles were dead, dark, and stinky. And the PAHs, the aromatic hydrocarbons, went from 10,000 parts per million to less than 200 in 8 weeks. The last image we don't have, the entire pile was a green berm of life. These are gateway species, vanguard species that opened the door for other biological communities. So I invented burlap sacks, bunker spawn, and putting the mycelium using storm-blown debris. You can take these burlap sacks and put them downstream from a farm that's producing E. coli or other waste, or a factory with chemical toxins, and it leads to habitat restoration. So we set up a site in Mason County, Washington, and we've seen a dramatic decrease in the amount of coliforms. And I'll show you a graph here. This is a logarithmic scale, 10 to the 8th power is more than 100 million colonies per gram, and 10 to the 3rd power is around 1,000. In 48 hours to 72 hours, these three mushroom species reduced the amount of coliform bacteria 10,000 times. Think of the implications. This is a space-conservative method that uses storm debris, and we can be guaranteed that we'll have storms every year. So this one mushroom in particular has drawn our interest over time. This is my wife, Dusty, with a mushroom called Fomitopsis officinalis, agaricon. It's a mushroom exclusive to the old-growth forest that Dioscorides first described in 65 AD as a treatment against consumption. This mushroom grows in Washington State, Oregon, Northern California, British Columbia, now thought to be extinct in Europe. It may not seem that large. Let's get closer. This is an extremely rare fungus. our team, and we have a team of experts that go out. We went out 20 times in the old growth forest last year. We found one sample to be able to get into culture. Preserving the genome of these fungi in the old growth forest, I think, is absolutely critical for human health. I've been involved with the U.S. Defense Department BioShield program. We submitted over 300 samples of mushrooms that we boiled in hot water and mycelium, harvesting these extracellular metabolites. And a few years ago, we received these results. We have three different strains of agarikon mushrooms that were highly active against pox viruses. Dr. Earl Kern, who's a smallpox expert of the U.S. Defense Department, states that any compounds that have a selectivity index of two or more are active, 10 or greater are considered to be very active. Our mushroom strains were in the highly active range. There's a vetted press release that you can read that's vetted by DOD if you Google Stamets and smallpox, or you can go to npr.org and listen to a live interview. So, encouraged by this, naturally we went to flu viruses. And so for the first time I'm showing this, we have three different strains of agarikon mushrooms, highly active against flu viruses. Here's the selectivity index numbers. Against pox you saw 10s and 20s. Now against flu viruses, compared to the ribavirin controls, we are having extraordinarily high activity. And we're using a natural extract within the same dosage window as a pure pharmaceutical. We tried against flu A viruses, H1N1, H3N2, as well as flu B viruses. So then we tried a blend, and then a blend combination. We tried it against H5N1, and we got greater than 1,000 selectivity index. I then think that we can make the argument that we should save the old growth forest as a matter of national defense. Yes. I became interested in entomopathogenic fungi, fungi that kill insects. Our house is being destroyed by carpenter ants. So I went to the EPA homepage, and they were recommending studies with metarhizium species, a group of fungi that kill carpenter ants, as well as termites. I did something that nobody else had done. I actually chased the mycelium when it stopped producing spores. These are spores. This is no spores. I was able to morph the culture into a non-sporulating form. And so the industry has spent over $100 million specifically on bait stations to prevent termites from eating your house. But the insects aren't stupid. They would avoid the spores when they came close. And so I morphed the cultures into a non-sporulating form. And I got my daughter's Barbie doll dish. I put it right with a bunch of carpenter ants were making debris fields every day in my house. And the ants were attracted to the mycelium because there's no spores. They gave it to the queen. 1 week later, I had no sawdust piles whatsoever. And then a delicate dance between dinner and death. The mycelium is consumed by the ants. They become mummified, and boing, a mushroom pops out of their head. Now, after sporulation, the spores repel, so the house is no longer suitable for invasion. So you have a near-permanent solution for reinvasion of termites. And so my house came down. I received my first patent against carpenter ants, termites, and fire ants. Then we tried extracts, and lo and behold, we can steer insects to different directions. This has huge implications. I then received my second patent. This is a big one. It's been called an Alexander Graham Bell patent, because it covers over 200,000 species. This is the most disruptive technology, I've been told by executives of the pesticide industry, that they have ever witnessed. This could totally revamp the pesticide industries throughout the world. You could fly 100 PhD students under the umbrella of this concept, because my supposition is that entomopathogenic fungi, prior to sporulation, attract the very insects that are otherwise repelled by those spores. And so I came up with a life box, because I needed a delivery system. The life box, you could be getting a DVD of the TED conference. You add soil, you add water, you have mycorrhizal and endophytic fungi, as well as spores like of the agarikon mushroom. The seeds then are mothered by this mycelium. And then you put trees, seeds in here, and then you end up growing potentially an old growth forest from a cardboard box. I want to reinvent the delivery system and the use of cardboard around the world so they become ecological footprints. If there's a YouTube-like a site that you could put up, you can make it interactive, zip code specific, where people could join together, and through satellite imaging systems, through Virtual Earth or Google Earth, you could confirm carbon credits are being sequestered by the trees that are coming through life boxes. You could take a cardboard box delivering shoes. You could add water. I developed this for DARPA, for the refugee community, corns, beans, and squash, and onions. I took several containers. My wife said if I could do this, anybody could. And I ended up growing a seed garden. And you harvested the seeds. And thank you, Eric Rasmussen, for your help on this. And then harvesting the seed garden, then you can harvest the kernels. And then I just need a few kernels. I add mycelium to it. And then I inoculate the corn cobs. Now, three corn cobs, no other grain, lots of mushrooms begin to form, too many withdrawals from the carbon bank. And so this population will be shut down. But watch what happens here. The mushrooms that are harvested, but very importantly, the mycelium is converted to cellulose and to fungal sugars. And so I thought, how could we address the energy crisis in this country? And we came up with ethanol. Generating ethanol from cellulose using mycelium as an intermediary, and you gain all the benefits that I've described to you already. But to go from cellulose to ethanol is ecologically unintelligent, and I think that we need to be ecologically intelligent about the generation of fuels, so we build the carbon banks on the planet, renew the soils. These are the species that we need to join with. I think engaging mycelium can help save the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul Stamets. I sometimes wonder how God came to invent passion and meld it into our genetic code. There is a mystical link between passion and life, and every day brings us new reason to find our passion and act. That's what we do here each week on the Weekly Earth Summit, in the hopes it will grow like mushroom mycelium throughout the global network of hope. You're encouraged to join us each week here at the Weekly Earth Summit. With so many ways to save the world, you'd think we could get this done in about a year or two, but for reasons often obscure, it seems the challenges keep mushrooming out of control. When we return, we take a look at the emerging global systems that are developing to define and create our future. When your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Everything's taking on global significance as the world becomes increasingly interdependent. Everyone's in everyone's business, and there's only so much to go around. So what's up for the globalizing planet? You'll find out when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News. Since I began the Wild Side News in March of 2004, I've done a total of about 213 shows. I haven't counted the total number of people I've interviewed, but it's probably well over 400 and maybe even closer to 500. A lot has changed in that time. 2004 was a presidential election year, so George Bush was actively running for his second term as president. The price of a barrel of oil in 2004 was $27. Global warming was something only environmental wackos talked about. and clean tech was still green tech. Total wind power was about 39 megawatts. It's now 90. Solar production was at about 20 megawatts. This year, it will be 400 megawatts. And over the last 4 years, we've come to acknowledge a whole new level of serious environmental threats. Fully 30% of the amphibians are on the endangered species list, and their future is unsure. It's become obvious that much of our oceans are depleted of fish. Since 1950, 33% of all fish species have gone into collapse and could be completely gone by 2040. And while the population continues to grow, some interesting things are happening to the distribution of wealth around the planet. China's economic growth is booming as millions of Chinese find their society emerging into a consumerist nation. India also adds to the demands on the world's limited resources. And yet, as China and India grow, American debt skyrockets. It just seems that things are kind of spinning out of control. We have a new dilemma, the emerging global economy, where we are all tied to the same boat. Jobs are moving to the lowest bidder, which means that American jobs in production have fled the country. We're bringing in food from around the world, and countries are now competing for the limited food supplies, driving up the cost of rice and bringing on panic and riots in less developed countries around the world, as people once self-sustaining cannot afford even the basics of existence. And in many cases cannot use traditional seeds as global corporations own the patents to their genetic codes because they can print them out on patent forms. Demands for all resources are driving the price of everything up, and there's nothing that indicates anything is going to turn this trend around, increasing the cost of virtually everything in this globally linked economy. Even our efforts to address global warming and our diminishing energy supplies have inspired millions of dollars of investment in ethanol from corn. But with that comes the charge that ethanol production is a crime against humanity, as it could bring on food shortages and rising prices to people least able to do anything about it. And the proud and well-intentioned new biofuel fat cats are now in an embarrassing struggle with environmental energy experts who say it was a bad idea to begin with. And billions of dollars of clean tech capital teeter on the judgment. And the environmental community is a calloused bunch when it comes to the bottom line, in this case, total energy in versus total energy out. So what's the point of all of this on a show about nature and the environment? Well, over these past 4 years of producing the Wildside News, I've talked with hundreds of experts on almost all of these topics that I've just referred to. And what I've observed is hundreds of well-intentioned people running full speed into their best effort to do something to save this earth. But the problem gets really tough in that with almost any approach, someone somewhere is going to be impacted. As for example, rainforests are now being torn out to grow corn for ethanol. It's a paradox wrapped in an enigma with a short fuse lit and the world in the balance. And now we face the new fast path to a blind curve as population continues to increase, and so too the demand for the good life in China, in India, in Africa, in South America, in a market-driven economy that is based on ongoing growth of things and stuff and convenience and prosperity. How will we address the fact that the Earth cannot sustain such a global taking of what is left, whether it be fish, feed, or fuel, or almost everything else? Things are getting tight. We are witnessing increasing outbursts of rage to the suffering, starvation, and disruptions to an ancient form of social sustainability as it becomes unmanageable. Around the world, a sense of global instability is rattling the fabric of hope. Many of these regional competitions are taking the form now of armed struggle, as evidenced by America's war on terror with an enemy we cannot even see anymore. In this struggle, we have seen hundreds of billions of dollars of our money being spent on a war in Iraq, Money that had been spent, for example, on health care, energy independence, education, job training, could have helped our great nation continue into the 21st century as one of the world's leaders for a great world of diversity and peace. But alas, this conundrum of conflict is resulting in perhaps millions of homeowners losing their homes as America's dollar and its honor slide to new lows. Workers are losing their jobs. The economy is heading for, if not already, in a recession. Workers are losing their jobs. The economy is heading for, if not already in, a recession, with some predicting even worse. And yet somehow we keep believing a magic genie will appear to make it all right. And in the name of national security, personal liberties and freedoms are being curtailed, removed, and violated. A lot has changed in the last 4 years. And yet there are unlimited great ideas and technologies that offer promise, whether it be in wind and solar power, new energy efficiencies, cradle-to-cradle production modeling, electric and hydrogen cars, large sail-assisted ocean-going tankers. The idea maestros are flying off to every conceivable conference around the world to talk and give PowerPoint presentations to all the wonderful Imagineers with the hopes that their idea will make the difference and save the world. Unfortunately, these good ideas also are tied to the global economy, and little will ever happen without proper funding, and there's little cooperation when it comes to capital, even for a better world. Experts abound on every topic, on economics, global warming, energy independence, nanotechnologies, sustainability, going green, buying local, cradle to grave, cap and trade, carbon credits, water shortages, climate change, mass extinction. I've talked to them all. But after 4 years, it actually feels as if we're pulling all in our own direction. And as time progresses, pulling even harder for our own survival. And despite the promise of real solutions, the problems spread faster than the cures. And to many of us, it seems like we're headed for a global crisis as the matrix of conflicting interests and lack of effective management pull our global social order into an epic and chaotic battle to see who comes out on top. A lot of bets are on China these days. It feels each day as if what we really need is a unified approach to what feels like an emerging global meltdown. Well, I'm here to make the point that there is just such an effort to unify the chaotic interests of the world into a global response, and it's been around for a very long time. We've all become aware that so much of this seems to ride on the unfamiliar whims of this global economy. Many would say to a large degree coalescing around an ever-tightening consolidation of power and wealth into fewer and fewer corporations. It's become fashionable to apply the term global to just about everything, whether it be a global economy, the global war on terror, the global water shortage, global warming, global food crisis, all of which are part of the process of globalization. We've all heard the warning by President Eisenhower as he left office about this trend toward a centralization of power around what he termed the military-industrial complex.
Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development. yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. Today, the solitary inventor, tinkering in his shop, has been overshadowed by task forces of scientists in laboratories and testing fields. In the same fashion, the free university, historically the fountainhead of free ideas and scientific discovery, has experienced a revolution in the conduct of research. Partly because of the huge costs involved, a government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. For every old blackboard, there are now hundreds of new electronic computers. The prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocations, and the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded. Yet in holding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite. As we peer into society's future, we, you and I, and our government must avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage.
But that was Ike, and it was then. And yes, he probably had it right, but so what are we supposed to do? We've come a long way since then, and in fact, this consolidation of power into a centralized system has an emerging and well-documented history. Leaders have been talking about this for years. It just seems to never have traction in the mainstream media, which they continue to consolidate. Clear Channel is being bought by yet another large private investment consortium as we speak. There are enormously powerful think tanks that have had the stated goal of creating a one-world system. They don't hide it. It's not some secret conspiracy. Lots of important people are fully aware of this unique vision. One such, the World Federalist Society, makes an annual award to individuals who promote such. In his acceptance speech in 1999, here is what the most trusted man in America had to say about a world government. The award was given to Walter Cronkite.
Thank you very much. Today we must develop federal structures on a global level to deal with world problems. We need a system of enforceable world law, a democratic federal world government.
And at the time, then First Lady Hillary Clinton even voiced her support for his vision.
For decades you told us the way it is. But tonight, we honor you for fighting for the way it could be.
Now, I know some listeners are probably getting ready to quit about here, as this is beginning to sound a bit too conspiratorial or something. But in fact, the globalization effort has many faces, many of whom we see every day, and who are out front discussing the future of a world system. This is from a recent speech by Gordon Brown, Prime Minister of Great Britain.
All these new challenges are bringing together about the biggest restructuring we have ever seen, not just of the global economy, but of the global order as a whole. And 200 years ago, a famous British foreign secretary said that the new world had been called into existence to redress the balance of the old. In 1990, another old world ended, dominated by the Cold War, and people talked then, in 1990, of a new world order. What they actually meant then was a new political order. And what was not foreseen then, but is obvious now from everything that we see and do, What we experience in every day of our life is the sheer scale and speed and scope of globalization. And it's only now that we can begin to understand that the world order that globalization brings and what it's going to look like, it's driven forward now not just by the balance of military strength, the Cold War times, or ordinary political power. It's being driven forward by a seismic shift in economic power that we see around us. So, in conclusion, ladies and gentlemen, a new world is emerging. It is a new world order with significantly different and radically new challenges for the future.
The fact is that at the highest levels of power, the emergence of a global system is in process. Here's a bit of an extended interview by Charlie Rose with Henry Kissinger.
Are we at one of those moments in history in which there is the necessity for a new world order? A, because of what's taken place in the Middle East, the rise of different kinds of groups, and B, what's happened in Asia, meaning that there has been a shift from the West to the East.
There's a need for a new world order, but it has different characteristics in different parts of the world. Just to go back to Iraq for a moment.
Right.
On the one hand, the manifestations of what is going on in Iraq are depressing and give some occasion for pessimism. On the other hand, simply as looking at somebody as a student of the future, I find it sort of interesting that there is now going on conversations inside Iraq between the various parties, not going very far yet. Secondly, that there is a meeting of ambassadors which will graduate to foreign ministers of all surrounding countries, plus Egypt, plus the members of the Security Council. And that people are talking of broadening yet a third level in which you would bring in India, Pakistan, Indonesia. Now, none of this may succeed this time, but this to me is sort of the outline by which someday, in the next few years, a solution will emerge, that people will look into that cauldron and decide that they have to learn their limits, not just we, but everybody else. I want to make one point about globalization. It's always discussed in economic terms that everybody is better off, but that is only partially true. Everybody is better off on the average, but in some countries or in some regions, people lose their jobs. Major adjustments have to be made. That's the engine of globalization. The people who are disadvantaged by the process look to their governments for solutions. But the governments are national and the problem is global. So how to bring about a relationship between the desirable process of globalization and its impact on the politics?
You're encouraged that China will get better and will grow and will be a more responsive citizen of the world?
I could write a script where this will not happen because the pressures inside China are enormous to deal with so many
problems. But it's incumbent on the next president to be able to...
I would say to the new president, what I'm saying to the current president, or I've said to previous presidents, the relations with China are the fundamental challenge of American policy. Because if we get that wrong, then much else we may do right is going to be subsumed in an attention to a conflict like the Cold War. And that is something that we must really avoid. And if we want to have a constructive world, the purely strategic and military problems that the shift in power relationships brings will confuse us if we do not consider that we have to bring about, together with other countries, a different consciousness of what a world order is. Now you have, on the one extreme, globalization, in which the nation is weakened. On the other extreme, you have religion. In between, you still have traditional states, and how you can get an international system in a world that is states and all these other movements, that is bound to produce problems. But I have actually, especially in the last month, developed the thought that yes, we are living in a period of tremendous turmoil now. But I think that at the end of this administration, with all its turmoil, and at the beginning of the next, we might actually witness the creation of a new order, because people looking in the abyss, even in the Islamic world, have to conclude that at some point ordered expectations must return under a different system. But you cannot wake up every morning wondering what horror is going to befall you. Yes, we are in a I find it interesting that somebody called a conference of ambassadors in Baghdad of all the surrounding countries, plus the Security Council, and everybody came. And it hasn't broken up. Of course it didn't settle anything yet, and it won't very necessarily quickly, but then they're adjourning to a foreign minister's meeting. Now, it's just the beginning, a very small step, on a road which either this administration will have to travel further, or a new administration. Somewhere along the line, something like this must happen.
That's an appropriate place to end this conversation, and as the beginning of a series of conversations, but it is to recognize that we are at one of those moments.
Absolutely.
Where there are forces at work, and
which
that people may be coming to an idea that we're looking at an abyss and need to come back from it, and you see some hope that might be starting.
It's also a great opportunity.
Thank you for coming. Henry Kissinger, former Secretary of State. We began, as I said, the series of conversations with former Secretaries of State, with people from not just the United States, but other countries, talking about this new world order and where we go from here.
I guess one of my concerns is Mr. Kissinger's reference to those who will suffer. And he really isn't only talking about others. We just may be included in those who will be staring into the abyss. Now, in many respects, isn't this what I suggested was needed, a global response to this emerging matrix of conflict? Indeed, it is. That's what I suggested. But my question, and one that I think we must begin to address seriously, as plans are being made to create a world government based on a global economic model, is, should this new world order be tied together by an economic order? Or should we take the time to reconsider whether it is in fact a good thing for all of the Earth's people to be tied together, and therefore to suffer globally when the global economy slows, or even worse, really takes a nosedive, at which time many could find themselves without work and jobs, which translates to money, which allows people to eat, have a place to live, and enjoy life. And there would simply be no alternative available anywhere. We are living with the real effects of this experiment, as millions of people here are beginning to lose their homes because certain economic indicators and friends are determining who may work and who may not. It's troubling to me because I find these economic determinants often removed from any real value. As we look at our housing crisis, in which the values of homes are crashing, what really has changed? There's no real change in the will and spirit of working Americans. We've worked hard for years and fully expected to continue until retirement. But all of that is gone because of economic factors and deals gone wanting. And then people suffer, and they lose their equity, and often their self-worth, and families are destroyed, and people go hungry and homeless, and one wonders what will really happen to millions of people who lose their homes and cannot find work. It's a frightening scenario, but one which no one really wants to address. And yet it's happening right now. But the sad fact is that, in truth, this may be just the tip of the iceberg. It's amazing when we think that since I began broadcasting the Wild Side News 4 years ago, the price of a barrel of oil has quadrupled. While wages in many sectors, often driven by an alternative immigrant workforce willing to work for much less, remain stagnant or decline. Since the first of the year, a barrel of oil has gone up over 30%, while the price of gas has gone up by 50%. Within this one sector alone, energy and the price of gas, one has to wonder, how are working people here in America supposed to cope with these increases? The obvious answer is they'll have to buy less. But then doesn't that hurt the overall economy? Of course. The reliance on economic orders to determine the global human condition just may be outdated, inoperable, out of control, too complex, and fundamentally destructive to human societies. And it begs the question, in fact, why are we humans allowing our lives to hang on the whims of a market economy which is being absorbed into a one-world global economy and the dream of a global centralized government by a few at the top who apparently know what is best? After all, they do control the vast majority of wealth on the planet. They must know what they're doing, right? It's impossible and actually counterproductive to try to determine what is best for the whole world. Something we've witnessed painfully in the folly of the neoconic vision of American global dominance modeled on the Iraqi war. But it's not about America really anymore. It's about a new world order. But as an American, I feel an enormous loss of what was once a powerful system and vision, a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. It is ever more apparent that we are on a course toward a government of the new order, by the new order, and for the new order, the public be damned. It's been an amazing journey these last 4 years. In the months ahead, if you listen, you'll hear others voice their concerns. Interestingly, Ron Paul, who is still running for president, is releasing a new book in a few weeks entitled Revolution, a Manifesto. Those who have had the chance to read it say it is a good read. And to those who are really beginning to think this conversation is getting a bit too stretched out, I'd like to play an address by President John Kennedy to the American Newspaper Publishers Association.
Ladies and gentlemen, the very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. Even today, there is little value in opposing the threat of a closed society by imitating its arbitrary restrictions. Even today, there is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. That I do not intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control. And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned, no rumor is printed, no secret is revealed. No president should fear public scrutiny of his program, for from that scrutiny comes understanding, and from that understanding comes support or opposition, and both are necessary. I am not asking your newspapers to support an administration, but I am asking your help in the tremendous task of informing and alerting the American people. For I have complete confidence in the response and dedication of our citizens whenever they are fully informed. I not only could not stifle controversy among your readers, I welcome it. This administration intends to be candid about its errors. For as a wise man once said, an error doesn't become a mistake until you refuse to correct it. We intend to accept full responsibility for our errors, and we expect you to point them out when we miss them. Without debate, without criticism, no administration and no country can succeed, and no republic can survive. That is why the Athenian lawmaker Solon decreed it a crime for any citizen to shrink from controversy. And that is why our press was protected by the First Amendment, the only business in America specifically protected by the Constitution, not primarily to amuse and entertain, not to emphasize the trivial and the sentimental, not to simply give the public what it wants, but to inform, to arouse, to reflect, to state our dangers and our opportunities, to indicate our crises and our choices, to lead, mold, educate, and sometimes even anger public opinion. This means greater coverage and analysis of international news, for it is no longer far away and foreign, but close at hand and local. It means greater attention to improved understanding of the news, as well as improved transmission. And it means, finally, that government at all levels must meet its obligation to provide you with the fullest possible information outside the narrowest limits of national security. And so it is to the printing press, to the recorder of man's deeds, the keeper of his conscience, the courier of his news, that we look for strength and assistance, confident that with your help, man will be what he was born to be, free and independent.
I think it is time for we the people to begin once again to ask what we are about, what is in our best interests, and what we can do to assure life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And it may be time to indeed forge a new economic order, but one based somehow on the real global economy that relies on limited precious resources and an abundant living system that restores and provides, and a human spirit that desires peace and good neighbors, good health, and happy children. I don't pretend to have the answer, but I have now at least voiced my concern. I truly wonder what would happen if this emerging new world order were in fact of the people, by the people, and for the people, and of the earth, on the earth, and for the earth. Now that may be the basis of a new revolutionary pathway here on this, our little planet. Keep your eyes wide open. Find your passion. And do what needs to be done. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet next time or any time on the archives. when your voice of the earth continues to speak truth for the living here on the Wild Side News.